Well, good to see you all. Great to be here. Now, I know a lot of you believe that everything you get on the internet is misinformation, but you can get misinformation without going on the internet. I'm about to announce something that may be on the internet tomorrow because of all of you. But anyway, the poet who writes the best poem about the move of Cruz from shortstop to center field will be selected to throw out the first ball at next year's opener. So that's something unsubstantiated. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. I'm going to read a couple poems from The British Detective. This one is sort of the title poem. The poem I'm going to read is called The Corporation, but it's where the British detective appears and then disappears. One, it was some force, I won't say spirit, entered the humans and animals and changed them. Much fighting of a terrible nature. We hired a British detective, but he soon disappeared. Two, the young ship's captain was interested only in his marriage. Three, after the reception, the protagonist walked home alone. He thought about the young captain and the angry clan leaders, each nailing the symbol of his clan to the wall. The lighting along the boardwalk competed with the light of the moon on the water. There was no one around. Now, the next two poems are concerned Julianne Ferrier, whom some of you may know. The first one of the two is the concluding poem in The British Detective, and it's called Conversation with Jewel. What did I always tell you? What? I said, don't get caught napping. Don't let them catch you napping. And what happens? I open the newspapers, and there you are. Now, the next poem concerning Julianne Ferrier then is the first poem, and even then. And I don't know if anybody has noticed this, but I'm calling attention to it. So the first poem in Even Then is called Jewel Awake. I was sitting in my car reading a new translation of Dostoevsky. It was time to proceed. I closed my book and got out of the car. A blonde woman stood before me. Jewel, I said, it's you. Couple more poems from Even Then. There's a poem called Outpost. The light's not real good up here, so I'm struggling a little bit, but I'll manage. Push pins arrayed on the map. Blue, red, yellow, green. Some black along the coastline. Debris from the ceiling falls into my coffee. The weather keeps us inside. It makes the TV pictures snowy. Some of the rooms are empty and unheard. I'm sorry. Some of the rooms are empty and unheated. They call me the fisherman. Now, for the people who want to know what that poem's about, it's about John Jesus Angleton, who was the head of black ops for the CIA for many years. This next one is called Imagination. It's dedicated to Suzanne Fountain. From the balcony of the rented vacation apartment the two of you share in northern Arkansas, Horseshoe Bend, you look down to the lake in the moonlight, where two men are in the water, skinny dipping, one your poet lover, the other Benedict, the current pope. This is the magic of it. He can call the great or humble, the real or fanciful, living or dead, to his side in the moonlight. For your astonishment, just two older men occupying the water on a summer's night, enjoying the water on a summer's night. Because of that, I got a big interest in Pope Benedict, and he was really a great pope, so I recommend him. I was a big fan of John Paul II, and Benedict is really something. So now I'm going to read some newer poems. This is to show you you have nothing to fear. You can relax. This is called Patriot, July 4th, 2021. We're down here in Washington to do a reenactment of January 6th in Lafayette Park. I'm playing the part of a Democratic congressman who is doused with gasoline and set on fire. It's the least I can do for my country. Now, this is a poem which I suppose is self-explanatory, although there's a lot of additional material one could read. But this is the nuts and bolts of it. It's in a sense a biography. It's called A Brave and Gallant Man. And it's a series of parts. How many parts? I think there are three parts. Yeah. One, Patrick Cleburne. His inexhaustible supply of energy sprung from the conviction that the cause for which he fought was not only noble, it was a crusade of good against evil, of right against wrong. His romanticized vision of the issue at hand and his own sense of obligation encouraged him, energized him to hold the division together by sheer will. Two, July 4th, 1863. Once again, Cleburne was assigned to hold the bridgehead as the Army of Tennessee crossed the Elk. The troops trudged southward up onto the heights of the Cumberland Plateau, manhandling the wagons over the rough spots to bivouac in the open air of the plateau on the 4th of July. For the first time in weeks, the men could light fires and cook a warm meal without concern for either the rain or the proximity of the enemy. That same afternoon, though no one in Cleburne's division of the Army of Tennessee knew it, Pemberton's ragged garrison marched out of Vicksburg to stack arms and surrender. And in Pennsylvania, Lee's army began the retreat from the battlefield at Gettysburg. Three, Patrick Cleburne. He advocated freeing the slaves. This is their country too, and they'll fight to defend it. He never retreated unless under orders. He was killed leading his men over a fence in a charge against the enemy at Franklin, November 30th, 1864. Now the story behind the story, Cleburne was from Ireland, and at that time in Ireland when he was a young man, there were just a couple things you could do. You could starve to death by eating grass because the potatoes were shipped elsewhere. You could go to America or you could join the British Army. He joined the British Army. And then he came to America. He became a lawyer in Helena, Arkansas. I don't believe he owned slaves. That's not an issue here. But anyway, he saw the North as the equivalent of Great Britain and the South as the equivalent of Ireland. So he went with the South. Of course, he lived there as well. And he truly believed that the slaves would fight for the South if they were only freed. And of course, I personally don't agree with that. I don't think that would have happened. But it just shows he was a very unusual man, Patrick Cleburne. So anyway, to change the subject here, this is a poem called MD 2020. And I'll dedicate the reading of this poem to Dave Newman, who enjoys this type of subject. I got in the checkout line. A gorgeous young woman in front of me was buying a gallon of MD 2020 and several other dubious bottles. She wore a black and crimson jacket advertising the band Slayer and had visible tattoos. As she walked away, I said to the cashier, a mature Negro woman, 50 years ago, I would have gone home with her. Here's one called Russian Poetry. I remember the last time I saw Stanley Kunitz. He had just come back from Russia, where he had fallen in love with Bella Akhmatilina, such a beautiful woman. I have a copy of 50 Soviet Poets, a bilingual anthology published in Moscow in 1960. When Putin comes to America, I'm going to ask him to inscribe it for me. Now, I know a lot of people think we should have written poems about the pandemic, so of course I did. And that's what I'm going to do. The next one I'm going to read is from the pandemic. It's titled Carlotta's Return. The mask comes off. Bright red lipstick. I want to say it's really an honor and a privilege to have read with these folks before me. I really enjoyed those readings. One of the best books of poems I've read in the last few years is Jim Daniels' book, Gunshy. I recommend that if he has some of it for sale tonight. I'm still trying to sell my books. There's a bunch of them over there. So you're welcome to buy them. This is a poem called Caddy. My first job, 1950, a caddy at the country club in Clinton, Iowa. I was 10 years old and wanted my own money. We got $1.50 for 18 holes, 90 cents for nine. Carried the bags, there were no golf carts then. One day I caddied for Mrs. DuPont. DuPont had a cellophane plant in Clinton. They called them plants then, not factories. We just went nine holes, it was a sweltering day, temperature in the 90s. I collected my 90 cents and went to the caddy stand to go out again. There I was, a fat kid sweating in the heat. Mrs. DuPont spotted me and walked over. She handed me a nickel. Here, son, she said, get yourself a Coke. I've always remembered that kindness. Here's an advertisement for a reading, The Boatmaker's Art. So, when you get, I'm 84, I turned 84 recently, and when that happens, it's a little harder to organize things. Let me close by reading something more from Even Then. I appreciated the introduction by John. I read once with Terence Hayes at Hemingway's, and Joan introduced me. And Terence had read first, and of course he'd won the National Book Award and just about everything except the Nobel Peace Prize. And then when Joan introduced me, she told people that I'd won the 1980 Cosmet Conference MVP Award and various things, and that I had a sandwich named after me at Pittsburgh Steak Company. And Terence thought he was being made fun of. But anyway, those were my credits, so Joan was nice enough to list them. So I'm going to close with two poems from Even Then. One is a short one, In Suzanne's House. Everywhere one looks, there is a treat. A painting of red poppies in a vase, a pewter tea service. And the last poem I'm going to read is called The Hotel Earl. Anybody here ever stay at the Hotel Earl? You missed out. I talk about it here in this poem. Finally burned down. Correspondences. Tom Russell in a concert at Pittsburgh Center for the Arts mentions the Hotel Earl in Greenwich Village, a cheap place for musicians to stay back in the day. Then in Lisa Jarno's biography of Robert Duncan, she mentions Duncan stayed at the Hotel Earl in April 1962, on one of his visits to New York City. correspondences. What do you do if you're two white girls and a black guy? Judy Jones, Sue Rare, and Lenny King. It's 1962 and you've just met in New York City. And you're in bed together at the Hotel Earl. What do you do? Well, you phone Michael back in Carlisle at 2 a.m. to share the joy. Correspondences. The Hotel Earl became a welfare hotel and burned down. Bob Nelson's father lived there. He was murdered in 1971 in Central Park. I remember a nearby mission. They had great soup and donuts. You had to listen to the sermon first. Thank you for your attention. It's been great. Thank you all. God bless.